So we've talked about 313 in this conference before, and those presentations in the past have typically been about the nuts and bolts of the program or about the long, arduous application process in the program. But as our topic description says, you know, we're focused on the next step. And so you've got your 313 agreement, you've survived the long slog, and you've been bludgeoned to death, and you've made it to the end, right? And you've got the signed agreement. What happens next? What are your obligations at that point? How do you keep it? What are the compliance and reporting steps that you've got to take under that agreement? And so that's our topic today. And so Evan's going to do most of the heavy lifting on that subject. I'm starting off really just to kind of review the nuts and bolts of 313 a little bit in a quick summary in the next 7 or 8 minutes or so, and to kind of remind you of a bit of the unique vocabulary that goes along with these agreements. So when Evan talks about the compliance and reporting, hopefully we're all on the same page and have the same context together. And so we're going to start with a brief overview. Evan's going to talk about compliance and reporting. I'm going to come back up at the end to talk about disputes and audits under 313 agreements and what that looks like. And so just to reorient the group to Chapter 313 agreements, Chapter 313 agreements are a value limitation agreement. They're not a tax abatement. And so tax abatements are agreements you sign with every local property tax jurisdiction except for school districts. School districts, you sign value limitation agreements. What does that mean? That means for a 10-year period, no matter what the fair market value of your equipment is sitting out there, the solar equipment, the wind equipment, no matter what the fair market value is, the school district is going to agree to tax you as if it was worth a lower arbitrary number. And so for rural school districts, that's anywhere from $1 million to $30 million. For non-rural districts, that's anywhere from $20 million to $100 million. And so being able to be taxed at that lower value for 10 years offers a unique and typically a very large tax incentive for the project. And you don't get to negotiate that number. That value limitation amount is what the statute calls it. That's assigned by the controller. And so it depends on the relative property wealth of the school district. Each school district will be assigned a value limitation amount. So you don't get to negotiate it. You apply for the agreement. If you're successful in obtaining the agreement, you get that deal. You get that incentive. As a condition to receiving that value limitation, the agreement will require that you make a minimum amount of investment in a local school district. That's called the qualified investment. And again, that number is set by the controller. So in order to receive that $30 million value limitation, you may be required to make a $30 million investment in the district. That's the qualified investment. And the second condition is that you are required to create a certain number of what the statute calls qualifying jobs. If you're in a non-rural district, you have to create 25 jobs. I mean, yes, 25. In a rural district, it's 10. However, the statute does give the opportunity to obtain a waiver or a reduction of that number if the industry standard for operating the facility is lower than the 25 or 10 required by the statute. And as Charlie's panel mentioned yesterday, that was one of the attempts that folks that aren't so friendly to renewables tried to tweak in the statute to make it harder for renewable projects to obtain the incentive, is to remove the potential of a job waiver. But right now, that's still a part of the program, and it needs to remain a part of the program for these to continue to be useful for these projects. Now, again, getting into the unique vocabulary of Chapter 313, Chapter 313 agreements revolve around three different time periods. There's what's called the qualifying time period. That's a period of anywhere from 2 years to 2 years and 364 days during which you have to make that required qualified investment. So for most renewable projects, you can kind of equate that to a construction period. So you've got the qualifying time period. It sometimes can start right away. It can sometimes be deferred, but you've got these 2+ years in which to make the qualified investment. The second time period in these agreements is called the tax limitation period. The tax limitation period is the 10 years during which you will receive the tax incentive. Now, the statute says that you have to start that tax limitation period in one of three key dates. It either has to be January 1 of the year after you file the application. That's not typically a choice that's made by renewable projects. Or it's January 1 of the year after the qualifying time period ends, so you can start the tax limitation period as soon as the qualifying time period ends. Or it's January 1 of the year after you reach commercial operations. So those are the three choices for beginning that 10-year tax limitation period. The tax limitation period and the qualifying time period can overlap. There can also be gap years in between the two, the way you set up the timeline of your application. Then the third time period is the maintained viable presence period. That's the 5 years after the end of the tax limitation period during which you commit to making sure that project remains operational. If it doesn't remain operational for that 5 year maintained viable presence period, you can forfeit everything under the agreement. And so the agreements will cover these three time periods. Some other key terms under these agreements. We talked about qualified investment already. That's all the new buildings and all the new equipment that you construct or install inside the school district, but it only applies to what's installed during that qualifying time period. And again, there's going to be a certain amount of investment you have to make during the qualifying time period. Now, contrast that with the definition of qualified property, and qualified property is all of the property to which the value limitation will apply. And so that's all of the new buildings, all the new construction. It can also include land that is in place for the project. And so qualified property can include property that was put in place after the end of the qualifying time period or even before the qualifying time period commenced. But it just cannot include anything that was out there in place before the application was approved. If it's already there before you filed your application, it's not going to get the tax incentive. It can't be qualified property.